from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the UN Security Council met Sunday to consider the situation in Gaza, the Palestinian envoy to the United Nations criticized the council for its inaction against the Israeli onslaught against the Gaza Strip. But he said he has not given up and would continue to try to get the matter to a proper resolution when the council meets again Tuesday.
I am sure that all of you are aware of the fact that a heinous massacre has been committed against our people in the Gaza Strip early this morning in the Ashjaiya community area in the Gaza Strip. And I believe that the number of Palestinian killed, martyred, is in the vicinity of 100 in that area, and the injured are in the hundreds and approaching 500. The largest number of them are civilians, and there is no justification for this massacre committed against our people. And President Abbas instructed me to ask the Security Council to meet in an emergency session and to shoulder its responsibility in putting an end to this carnage against our people. The Council failed again and again in shouldering its responsibility. Nevertheless, we are not giving up, and we are coming back, knocking on the door of the Security Council to shoulder its responsibility and to stop this massacre against our people. The Council, I understand now, it's meeting in a closed session. Our preference was to have an open meeting, but regardless of the format of the meeting of the Security Council, we want the Security Council to shoulder its responsibility and to stop this aggression against our people, which should be condemned, and we condemn that, and protection for the Palestinian people to be provided. We will see exactly if the Security Council will rise to this responsibility. And this is the third time that we come to the Security Council since this aggression. And our people are extremely frustrated and fed up with the Security Council and the international community because they are not doing what they should be doing in order to stop this aggression against our people. If the Security Council, the party, the body that is supposed to be responsible for international peace and security, is not stopping this killing against our people, where should we go in order to seek justice, in order to seek stopping this aggression against our people? We will not give up in coming back again and again to the Security Council. We hope that the Security Council tonight to rise up to the level of shouldering its responsibility to stop this carnage against our people. I know that we will be coming back to the Security Council Tuesday, where tens of countries will be speaking openly in the Security Council. We are not interested in debates and discussions and talks in the Security Council or in other body. What we are interested in is to see action to put an end to the misery of our people. Tens of thousands are displaced. They're living in UNRWA UN schools. The tragedy in Gaza is beyond comprehension. The hospitals are overwhelmed with number of injured civilians. The equipments are not sufficient. The medicine is not sufficient to deal with the needs of our people. This crime has to be stopped, and it has to be stopped immediately. And our people are demanding that those criminals who are committing these crimes against civilians, in which in the more than 450 killed so far, about 112 of them are children, large number of them are women, large number of them elderly and disabled, and those who are committing these crimes against our people should be held responsible and should be facing justice.
Permanent representative of Rwanda, Eugene Richard Gasana, is the acting president of the Security Council for July. He gave some details of a partial agreement which was reached late Sunday.
So, good evening, everybody. The Security Council has just concluded its closed consultations on the situation in the Middle East, including, of course, the question in Palestine. It was a sobering session, considering the serious situation in Gaza. So we read now elements of press that were agreed upon the Council. The members of the Security Council expressed serious concern at the escalation of violence in the situation related to Gaza. The members of Security Council called for respect of international humanitarian law, including protection of civilians. The members of Security Council emphasized the need to improve the humanitarian situation, including through humanitarian pauses. The members of the Security Council expressed serious concern about the growing number of casualties. The members of the Security Council called for an immediate cessation of hostilities based on a return to the November 2012 ceasefire agreement. The members of the Security Council welcomed the efforts of Egypt to broker a ceasefire, as well as those of the Secretary General. I thank you.
And although the Security Council is set to reconvene Tuesday on the situation in Gaza, another UN organ, the Human Rights Council, is expected to begin its own review on Wednesday. Patrick Maigwa reports from Geneva.
The Geneva-based UN Human Rights Council is to convene a special session on Wednesday, 23rd July, to discuss the situation in Gaza. The session has been requested by Egypt and Pakistan with the support of 15 members of the council, among them China, Cuba, the Russian Federation, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa. On Sunday, the UN Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is in the region as part of a visit which aims to express solidarity with Israelis and Palestinians and help bring about a ceasefire. The United Nations Agency providing assistance to Palestinians, UNRWA, says over 81,000 Palestinians have now sought refuge in 61 shelters. UNRWA says the shelters have a peak capacity of 50,000 people. Media reports indicate that over 500 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the latest Israeli military offensive in Gaza. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations, Geneva.
Meanwhile, it appears that some aid was on the way to the besieged people of Gaza on Sunday. We have this report from Stephanie Kotrix at the UN.
A special airlift in support of displaced families in Gaza began on Sunday from Dubai, where a cargo took off carrying humanitarian aid, according to the United Nations Agency Assisting Palestinians, or UNRWA. The number of displaced coming to UNRWA in Gaza may soon be as high as 100,000 due to ongoing fighting between Israel and Palestine. In response to this, international aid agencies mobilized relief efforts, coordinated by the International Humanitarian City based in the United Arab Emirates. Participating agencies included the UN's Refugee Agency, the World Food Program, and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. The airlift, which landed at Marka International Airport in Amman early on Monday, reportedly contained 115 metric tons of aid, including 45,000 mattresses, 10,000 blankets, and 220 hygiene kits. Pierre Krahenboul, UNRWA's Commissioner General said that in the coming days, more airlifts are scheduled to arrive in Amman, from where UNRWA will truck the aid into Gaza for distribution. Meanwhile, on Sunday, the Secretary General of the United Nations was in Doha, Qatar, calling for an immediate ceasefire. Ban Ki-moon said he will be visiting the countries in the region, including Egypt, Ramallah, and Israel, and will go wherever he needs to be. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The fighting took a heavy toll over the weekend, with hundreds more civilians dead in Gaza and some military casualties on both sides. It continued into Monday, with at least 39 Palestinian civilians reportedly killed by press time late Monday, bringing the total dead to more than 500 over the past 14 days. Press TV's Akram al-Sitari was in Gaza earlier Monday.
Well, the latest is that the Israeli occupation forces are targeting large areas into Khan Yunis city, causing people to run from their houses as a result of the heavy bombardments targeting the area. The Israeli occupation forces are targeting a Shaja'iya neighborhood also with the white phosphorus bombs and with the large scale bombs into the area. Also in the Gaza north, there are some news about recent attacks, at least two attacks against civilian homes in the area of Beit Hanun. The news that are coming from the other side, from Palestine Occupied 48, say that at least five Israeli soldiers were killed by the Palestinian fire. Israelis are now publishing the names of the soldiers who were killed. They are saying that there is a massive loss in among the soldiers, and that many other soldiers were injured, and the clashes are still continuous. Al-Qassam brigades are publishing a video. In that video, they are showing how they gunned down an Israeli soldier by a sniper fire. The situation is escalating. The Palestinian resistance is retaliating. The Israelis are still aggravating the situation by their ongoing fire all over the Gaza Strip. The victims are still falling. The injured people are still taken to the hospitals that are suffering to still provide their services to the people in the Gaza Strip. The health system is being under a heavy, increasingly heavy burden. The people are still in the UN schools, and more people are joining now after the heavy bombardment in Khan Yunis area. And that is overburdening also the UN that is trying to provide to the people in their hospitals, in their schools. Now the situation is getting harsh and harsher, and there's expected to be more victims soon.
And Akram, tell us about how the media is dealing with this situation, yourself, of course, and as well. We've, of course, seen the cameraman who was killed yesterday, and we've also seen Israeli warnings to foreign journalists as well.
Well, the journalist, if you saw the footage of the journalist who was killed, he was wearing such a vest just like mine, stating explicitly that he's a pressman. Israeli unmanned drones and the very sophisticated technology could, of course, observe that he was doing some journalistic work and he was covering the truth about what's happening in Gaza Strip. There might be, and I'm telling you this, the Israeli army usually issues explanations and statements about the different issues. They have not issued any explanation as yet, and we are waiting to know why would they target a civilian, a journalist. But what we learned from the past, that Israel doesn't mind targeting civilians. Israel doesn't mind killing journalists and media people as long as it's trying to cover their crimes. So there was a crime in Shaja'iya, and the top interest of the Israeli army was to cover that and to kill anyone who might be able to provide a very clear image about what was happening, because the very clear image about Shaja'iya was quite shocking and horrifying, and they were having an interest into covering that. And I think that's why they targeted the media people, and they also targeted a paramedic in the same area because they were preventing the ambulances from accessing the area and helping the people. So they are killing not only the journalists, but they are also killing the paramedics and killing everyone whomsoever is trying to help other people in the area or to unreveal the truth about their crimes against the people of Gaza.
CPR's Bernard White spoke with Dr. Jeff Halper, the coordinating director for the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, about the current situation in Gaza, how things got there, and what needs to be done to bring peace to the region. We will bring you that interview in its entirety tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Security Council met on Monday about the situation in Ukraine following an announcement by the Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak that an agreement had been reached with local militia members at the scene of the crash for the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 black boxes to be handed over to Malaysian authorities in Donetsk. The handover was set for 9 p.m. East European Summer Time or about 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. This followed a week-long barrage of claims by government officials and media outlets in the West that there was evidence that the plane was taken out by anti-missile fire from East Ukrainian separatists, and even some claims that Russian military personnel were involved. This brought sharp denials from Russian officials and some critique of the alleged evidence in Russian media, including the alleged recordings of intercepted phone calls between Russian military intelligence officers and Donetsk militia members discussing the flight being downed in eastern Ukraine. The Russian ambassador to India, Alexander Kadakin, told the daily newspaper The Hindi Monday that the so-called intercepts were totally fabricated fakes, saying that, quote, experts have proved that they were a montage of several separate cuttings done much before the airliner was shot down, closed quote. We have this from sound and speech analyst Nikolai Popov, who dissected the phone call intercept that Kiev alleges is the MH17 smoking gun.
It's being presented as one unedited recording. In reality, this audio file was compiled out of several fragments. The time markers are inconsistent at the part where it's being said the plane was downed by Cossacks. These markers reveal that one fragment was recorded at 16:33 and that the second fragment, which comes right afterwards, was recorded at 17:15.
On Monday, Russia's Federal Agency for Air Transportation said it was ready to share all information on the Malaysian passenger plane crash to an ICAO-led group of international experts investigating the crash. Earlier in the day, the Russian Defense Ministry released a video provided by the Rostov Air Traffic Control Center, which showed the movement of civil aircraft over Ukraine on the approaches to Russia's airspace. The Russian military also said it detected a Ukrainian Su-25 fighter jet moving towards the airliner and apparently tracking it. According to a statement from the Russian Defense Ministry, quote, a Ukraine Air Force military jet was detected gaining height. Its distance from the Malaysian Boeing was 3 to 5 kilometers. The Su-25 fighter jet can gain an altitude of 10 kilometers according to its specification. It's equipped with air-to-air R-60 missiles that can hit a target at a distance up to 12 kilometers, closed quote. In addition, the plane crashed within the operating zone of the Ukrainian Army's self-propelled medium-range surface-to-air Buk missiles, Russian Lieutenant General Andrei Kartopolov said at a Monday press conference in Moscow. He said that Russia has, quote, space images of certain places where the Ukraine's air defense was located in the southeast of the country, closed quote. He displayed the pictures to the press. The first three images were dated July 14th and showed Buk missile launch systems at about 5 miles northwest of the city of Lugansk. Another image shows a radar station near Donetsk. While one picture shows the location of the air defense systems near Donetsk, he explained, one can also see clearly a Talar launcher and about 60 military and auxiliary vehicles with tents and other structures at the site. The general said that images of the area were also taken on July 17th, and pointed out that the missile launcher was then absent. Another image shows the Buk missile system in the morning of the same day in the area of a settlement about 35 miles south of Donetsk. The Russian Defense Ministry also reported that, at the moment of the plane crash, an American satellite was flying over the area of eastern Ukraine. It urged the U.S. to publish the space photos and data captured by it. On Monday, U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf was asked what proof the U.S. actually had to support its claims that the plane was shot down by East Ukrainian separatists and with Russian help.
You are perhaps familiar with the briefing that the Russian Defense Ministry gave this morning, in which they laid out satellite images or radar tracking images talking about a Ukrainian fighter plane that was apparently near this the Malaysian Airlines plane. They also asked a series of questions to you, meaning the U.S. government, to produce the documentation, the evidence that mm-hmm. Secretary Kerry, Ambassador Power, talked about, but mm-hmm. didn't offer any, forensic evidence or at least intel evidence. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
Well, a couple points. You saw the Secretary yesterday speak very clearly about our assessment that this was an SA-11 fired from Russian-backed separatist-controlled territory. That we know we saw on social media afterwards, we saw videos, we saw photos of the pro-Russian separatists bragging about shooting down an aircraft that they then took down once it became clear that it may have been a passenger airline. There is a preponderance of evidence at this point, both sort of out there in the public domain and also from our information, that points to the fact that there was a SA-11 launched from separatist-controlled territory. We assess, of course, that the Russian-backed separatists have this system. And one of the main reasons we have called for a full investigation is so we can get all the facts out there. So what I would encourage the Russians to do at this point is to push the separatists that are backed by their government to allow access, to allow investigators who are in Ukraine waiting to go into that area right now, and that's what I would call on Russia to do at this point.
Right, but what they're saying is that they've put what they have out on the table, or at least they say they have.
Well, I haven't seen any of that. Again, we've made an assessment based on a broad range of information. We know this was fired from Russian-controlled territory. It is our assessment, very strong assessment. This was an SA-11 that we know the Russian-backed separatists have. We, again, continue to gather more information and call on Russia to push the separatists to allow for a full investigation.
How is it exactly that you know that it was fired from Russian, from separatist held territory?
Well, we have a great deal of information that the Secretary laid out yesterday, and I can go back through some of it today. But we do know, first, that Russian-backed separatists were in possession of an SA-11 system as early as Monday, July 14th. This is from intercepts of separatist communications posted on YouTube by the Ukrainian
government. Well, is there anything, is there anything other? Because,
I can keep going
is there stuff that's other than social media that.
Yes, absolutely, there is.
Okay, so what is it that's other than social media?
At this point, Matt, we've said what our assessment is, very strong assessment publicly. If there's more information that's based on that we can share, we're happy to do so. We'll continue looking at that. But look, this is what we know as of right now.
Eric Dreitzer is a political analyst based in New York. He maintains the website StopImperialism.org. We spoke with him from his office in Manhattan on Monday.
I think that what you're getting at is really an essential point here, and that is that long before an investigation has been conducted, long before objective facts have been ascertained, we see that the United States and the Western media generally is using this as a moment of opportunity, as a window of opportunity for themselves to capitalize on this this tragic downing of the airliner for their own geopolitical purposes, of course, not only in Eastern Ukraine, but in Eastern Europe more generally. And I think that that's part of the reason why we see this deluge of rumors and unsubstantiated claims about what happened. But as far as what we do actually know at the moment, it is still quite unclear exactly what happened. We've seen reports from Western media, including quoting of the Obama administration and the White House, which says that they can say for certain that these were launched by the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. Of course, this is a complete farce, considering the fact that not only have they not actually provided any of the hard evidence, that would be satellite photos, intercepted communications, or any other forms of on-the-ground or surveillance intelligence, but in fact, we do know that the Russians have now put out some very interesting hard evidence in relation to not only the eyewitness accounts regarding two other planes that may have been directly behind or next to this commercial airliner. The Russians have also put out some very interesting images and maps that show very questionable flight paths and very questionable circumstances surrounding why exactly this plane, this commercial airliner with passengers from Europe, was flown at lower than normal altitudes over a war zone. So what I'm getting at in saying that is not simply that we should take Russia's word for it or that we should take Washington's word for it, but rather there are hard evidence and real claims that are being made, and there are fantastical claims that are being made, and it's important that we delineate between those two.
One of the pieces of evidence that the Russians have released today supports a claim over it that, in fact, a Ukrainian fighter jet was tailing the airliner.
Exactly right. And again, the question would be, how do we link that observation or that claim, that allegation, with the hard evidence? And this is what a real investigation is supposed to show. What does the wreckage tell us about the nature of how that plane was downed? What do we know about the circumstances that led to it going down? What do the forensic evidence and the forensic data tell us about what happened? All of these are very important in actually putting together a concrete, verifiable, and objectively factual narrative. But of course, that is not what Washington is interested in at the moment. Washington knows that its puppet government that it installed directly and indirectly in Kiev was losing a war in eastern Ukraine, and it has seized on this opportunity to propagandize the notion that Russian imperialism, quote-unquote Russian expansionism and Russian imperialism, is to blame not only for the downing of the airliner, but it is to blame for the civil war in Ukraine. A complete inversion of reality, a complete distortion of the facts, but of course, that's what Washington specializes in.
Right. What do you think is likely to happen between Ukraine and the separatists, regardless of the outcome, once this thing is passed? Because we saw in Libya, for example, the original claim at the UN of Gaddafi strafing and firing on protesters from the air, refuted factually by Russian satellite surveillance photography, but that never made the narrative. It had no impact whatsoever, and most people still don't know that, 3 years later. Do you think the sorting out of the facts at some point is going to have an impact on the ground?
I think it absolutely will, and I would sort of remind listeners also that Russia was not invested in Libya the way that it is invested in Ukraine. Libya was not on Russia's border. Libya did not have centuries-old, millennial-old ties to Russia the way that Ukraine does. So I think the two are distinctly different. And this is not to excuse Russia's somewhat, I would say, half-hearted defense of Libya, certainly not to excuse that. But Russia has a very real set of strategic interests and self-defense interests with regard to Ukraine that were certainly not present in Libya. And I can, I would be willing to wager my paycheck to say that Russia will go to the wall to make sure that all of the intelligence, all of the facts, all of the data is put out there into the public arena, whether it's at the United Nations, whether it's in the media, in whatever form it may come. We will know a lot more about what happened in Ukraine than we ever did about what exactly happened in Libya. And I would also say that the situation in Ukraine is decidedly more complex. I think that there are many overlapping forces and overlapping interests at play in Ukraine, whereas in Libya, I think it was quite clearly a terror war that was used, that NATO used terrorist proxies in order to effect a regime change. Ukraine is a bit more complex, and I think that complexity is reflected in the way that Russia is handling it.
And then, of course, there's the case of Syria, where last August there was the allegation that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons. This was announced as fact, more or less, by the Obama administration. The Russians issued a report that demonstrated, in fact, any nerve gas, any chemical agents had come from the rebels and not from the Syrian government, and suddenly there was a brokered deal. Do you think that there's maybe some analogy there?
Absolutely, and I think that that's a pretty astute observation in the sense that once the United States-sponsored propaganda narrative began to fall apart, that is to say, once the various studies were issued, not only the Russian study, but also months later we had the study from MIT, we had a number of other studies, both on the ground and from international observers, which said quite clearly that the Assad government was not responsible for whatever the chemical attack on Ghouta was. And so I think that that is a very good parallel in the sense that we will have investigations, we will have intelligence, and we will have countervailing forces that are willing and able to balance out and to negate the lies and distortions that come from Washington. But again, I return to the first point that I made, and that is that we are right now in a very critical window of time, a very small window of time, in which the United States is trying to capitalize on this disaster on this tragedy as much as it possibly can. And the reason I say that is because, just as you're kind of intimating, I think that as the days and weeks go on, more and more will be found out about what exactly happened to that airliner, and it's not going to be good for the junta in Kiev, and it's not going to be good for their sponsors in Washington.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.